Welcome to Booty and Bossy Eat, Drink, Knit. This is our 31st episode.
Ba, 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 ba.
Yay! And Booty, would you like to start us off by sharing our recipe?
This is an oldie from our mom.
Hi, Mom.
It's actually, we did have it quite a bit in the summer. It's four bean salad, mom's famous four bean salad.
I think we can say that, yeah.
It's great because our kitchen is under renovation, so we have limited access to a stove. That being said, we have some friends of ours that very kindly offered their house, so I actually made this over at their house. Which was lovely. They have a really nice kitchen, very well organized, and really good equipment. Excellent knives.
Oh, good knives are very important. Yes.
Right? So, yes, now I have knife envy. I might need to get some.
That would be a good thing to christen your, I mean, you will have a very nice kitchen someday. And that would be a good gift to yourself, would be to get some good knives.
I did make it a little bit more fancy. The original recipe is four cans of beans. So you drain green beans, wax beans, kidney beans, garbanzo beans, whatever. You can mix and match whatever kind. You can do cannellini beans, whatever beans you want. You could do lima or black-eyed peas. You wouldn't want to do anything that had like a sauce in it.
Right.
And then I like to do a purple onion.
Yes.
And I don't actually eat any of the onion because I don't like onion. But I do think it adds a nice flavor to it. So I actually do like half of an onion thinly sliced.
Yes.
And we talked about this in a previous episode that Gordon Ramsay has this life-changing way of slicing onions. So, or you could chop them, I think, whatever, kind of easier.
Onions do seem to be the kind of thing that people either like or don't. And if you chop them up, it does make it harder for those who don't like onions to remove. Yeah.
Yes, I like the flavor. I just don't want, I don't know. And then the original recipe had a green pepper and I prefer red pepper. So
yes,
sliced red pepper. And then the dressing is, so the original recipe is half a cup of sugar. I halved that. It seemed like that.
That was a lot. Yeah.
Quarter cup of sugar, half a cup of salad oil, which I think we talked about is just, you could use, I used olive oil. You could use whatever.
I used half and half olive oil and canola oil just because I thought the olive oil might be a little heavy, but yeah.
Or avocado oil would be good. Half a cup of white wine vinegar.
I used red wine vinegar, but
a teaspoon of salt. Oh, and the recipe called for half a cup of water, but I didn't use that. That seemed weird. Half a teaspoon of dry mustard. I used regular mustard, probably more like a tablespoon. And half a teaspoon dried basil, half a teaspoon dried tarragon, and 2 tablespoons dried parsley. And then you just throw everything in a bowl and put your dressing on and let it marinate in the refrigerator for a couple hours. And
voila. Yes.
Voila.
I do remember, Mom, that, and this was the first recipe. I don't know if that's because she was starting with salads, but when she put together our family recipe book, this was the first recipe. And I do remember her bringing this to every, I mean, I think it was the bean version of Janet's damn brownies. It was Mom's four bean salad. And as a kid, I don't think I liked it all that much. I think it was because I generally didn't like raw onions. And I also didn't like green peppers. And I still don't like green peppers. I do now like onions. And I do feel that the onions and the I used a half a red pepper and a half a yellow pepper. Those give it a nice bite. I did share it with the ungrateful husband who said, I never like these bean salads. They're kind of mushy.
My husband didn't even eat. He didn't even try it. But my kids did, and they liked it.
Well, and now I realize probably as a kid, I mean, other than not liking the onions, it had a half a cup of sugar in it. I mean,
Right. That's what I liked as a kid.
yeah. I did add the water, and at the time I was like, I don't know why I'm adding the water, but and I would leave the water out. I because it made it a little watery. But my update, I used cannellini beans, so like white kidney beans, red kidney beans, and then garbanzos. And then I bought a fresh bag of green beans and just nuked them in the microwave and then burned my fingers taking them out. But I do think the fresh green beans are good. I also used fresh herbs, and that was good. After our sister talked about the importance of fresh herbs and considering herbs as another vegetable. So, and that definitely made it, I felt, brighter and tastier than the other just dried herbs that you would put into the dressing.
I also used fresh green beans. I actually boiled them in a little bit of salted water and till they were al dente. And I do think that it's important not to get them too cooked or undercooked. And to stop the cooking, I ran them under cold water since you're gonna put them in the fridge anyways.
Yeah.
There is something about this salad that says summer. Other than the sugar, it's relatively healthy. And I think you can make it more gourmet by adding the fresh herbs.
I did add some feta cheese to mine, and if I'd had some olives, that would have been good as a kind of Greek four bean salad version. But to me, this is the quintessential 1950s salad. Well, the fact that they call it a salad.
Right
But
there.
yeah. But I was reading Drew Gilpin Faust's memoir, Necessary Trouble, growing up at mid-century. I don't know if you, she was the first woman president of Harvard and a historian. And she has this great chapter in the middle of her memoir that talks about life in the 1950s. And one of the things that she says in painting the scene is that in the mid 50s, the average American family ate 850 cans of food annually. So everybody's eating 2.5 cans. Well, the family is eating 2.5 cans of food a day. The canned food thing was a phenom. She actually cites this issue of Life magazine, which you can look up Life magazine on Google Books and actually see it. And this was part of an issue that was January 3rd, 1955. It was a whole issue devoted to food. And in this one article, that was about ways to cut down kitchen work. And I thought this was such a great opening to the article. It says, in this almost servantless day, more servants are available to help with the work in US kitchens than ever before. Did you notice? Yeah. So these servants make it possible to prepare pleasant meals quickly. Best of all, they charge little for their services, are reliable, and never talk back.
Wow.
Yeah, they are the servants who come built into the frozen, canned, dehydrated, and pre-cooked foods, which lend busy women 1,000 extra hands in preparing daily meals. Unquote.
I love that. The 1,000 extra hands in here.
that, yeah, that when you're opening a can, when you think about it, I mean, somebody's cut the green beans, they've cooked them,
Washed them.
washed them, and prepped them, and all you have to do is open the can. But I'd never thought of a can as having tiny little servant hands. You're buying the food and you're buying the servant hands. I think it's really interesting too, because it's not just an argument for time saving. There's like this class argument embedded in there that using canned goods is like having servants.
Right. You too can live the high life.
Yes, by just opening a can.
Right.
It's the best kind of servitude because it's all unseen. So, like the gutting of the fish, which has to be in terrible conditions, probably pretty horrible conditions, but you don't see any of it. So you have the servitude and it's invisible.
Yes.
The actual labor is invisible. You're just enjoying the product of the labor. So the picture of the woman and her two daughters preparing this meal, and it says, a mother and her daughters can prepare a meal for eight in 20 minutes. And I should note here that the father and son are in the background reading or something or doing something, waiting for the meal to be prepared while the women are in the front. And they break down the meal into how long would it take you to make the equivalent meal if you didn't have canned goods or frozen or dehydrated. So the meal includes dehydrated onion soup, which would take 6 hours to make from start to finish, but takes 5 minutes to rehydrate and 15 minutes to heat. Frozen trout casserole, only no gutting of the fish, 10 minutes baking time. Frozen potato puffs, that would take 1.5 hours to make from scratch, and it's 15 minutes. Semi-baked bread and canned string beans and canned mushrooms, and then you mix them together.
They've got all these little pats of butter on the trout. That's like, you can never have too much butter on your trout. So I'm looking up the history of canning because there was a point in time where you didn't know what you were going to get.
Right.
It could be anything in your can. So I just looked up the history of canning. I've got from the Spruce Eats, the brief history of canning food. Apparently, in 1795, Napoleon Bonaparte offered a reward for whoever could develop a safe, reliable food preservation method for his constantly traveling army. And then it says Nicholas Appert took on the challenge and about 15 years later introduced a method that involved heat processing food in glass jars, reinforced with wire and sealing them with wax. Okay, so that's where it started. And then in 1810, Englishman Peter Durand introduced a method for sealing food in unbreakable tin cans. So then we have our metal cans. 1858, John Mason of the Mason jar invented a glass container with a screw on thread molded into its top and a lid with a rubber seal.
I think a woman invented that it was in part evaporated milk that was the tipping point for mass canning, because it was a way of preserving milk. But they didn't necessarily have a way for opening the cans.
Right, now what? I know that you could use a screwdriver.
Yeah.
Pierce the can. But yeah, I believe that the USDA at some point started regulating so you weren't getting mystery meat.
And actually, there's a good History Channel documentary on the history of food, and Henry Heinz of Heinz Ketchup, he was the one who pushed the formulation of the USDA in part to eliminate the competition because there weren't any standards. But ketchup was invented initially, I think, to basically cover up the taste of rotten meat.
Right. First, we had salt, pepper, ketchup. Yeah, that's so fascinating. I love these.
We'll put a link to the, like I said, the History Channel has a good, I think it's a three or four part episode about the rise of industrialized food. One of the things that the Life magazine points out is that there was just this incredible increase in productivity of food that in part came from people living in the city. And it talks about how in 1800, the average farmer produced enough food for himself and a third of another person. In 1955, with a population of 163.5 million, only 12% of the population worked in agriculture, and yet they produced enough to feed 17 other people besides themselves. So only 150 years later, and it's completely switched.
Right.
I love there's a certain frankness in the writing of Life magazine because they give these overviews of the incredible productivity, and then it says, quote, "All this gives Americans plenty of reason to be proud, but not smug."
That's classic.
So if you were starting to feel smug, pull back. No smugness here,
Too
American
far.
readers. That is too far. And that's the part about the obligation to help the rest of the world get caught up on our technological innovation with better food production.
Well, and our transition to knitting is that I think that knitting is a rebellion against the industrialization of clothing in a way.
Yeah, I did finally get around to watching that. The other, speaking of other documentaries, the Brandy Helville and the Cult of Fast Fashion on HBO. You had recommended it to me a while ago, and I did finally get around to watching this.
Fascinating and horrifying. I mean, on so many levels. So, for those of you that had, like me, had never heard of Brandy Melville, it's this clothing brand for teenagers, middle school
Sort of
teenager.
tween and
Yeah, widely popular. I don't know if it's still as popular, but their stores only sell one size. And the size is super, super small. At one point in the documentary, they compare a toddler-sized t-shirt to a Brandy Melville t-shirt. The Brandy Melville is actually smaller. So that's horrifying right there. That can you shop this store? It becomes a badge of honor, if you're small enough. Then, in terms of advertising, what they do is they have their customers post pictures of themselves wearing these outfits. And of course, because if they're wearing them, they're that size, they're basically traditional model size. And then that becomes another badge of honor that they're on the Instagram. Just mind-blowingly horrifying that these teenagers, it becomes a phenomenon that they fit into this clothing. It's cheap clothing. So the documentary has, so the one side is the horrors of Brandy Melville, and the other side is showing the places in Ghana where this all of this clothing winds up. And of course, it's not just Brandy Melville. It's Zara and all of those fast fashion brands that they're so cheaply made, they're not doing anything with it. It just winds up in the ocean, and it shows
Yeah.
these beaches that are just piles and piles of clothing that somehow gets, I don't know if it's the plastic in them or what, but they get welded together
Yeah.
in these deep piles. So, I mean,
Well, I think they just get twisted and
yeah.
turned, and they said that what you're seeing on the beach is probably a fraction of what's lining the ocean floor. And I didn't realize the degree to which, obviously, I'm not in the forefront of the cult of fast fashion, but it's the idea that basically you buy something to wear it while it's in style, and then you throw it out because you're buying the next thing. And the whole idea is you just continually are buying the latest fashion, but at the expense of what? I was not familiar with the Brandy Melville name. Apparently, there's still about 90 stores. And I guess it was founded by this middle-aged Italian guy, Stefan Marsan, I think was his name. I guess what's scary is he has this brilliant business model that basically feeds on all of the worst kind of insecurities of girls, particularly white girls.
He's racist and sexist, so that was also like, okay, he employs these young teenagers, and of course they are wearing the clothing from the store, but there's also he only has the white girls in the front of the store, and then anybody who's a minority is either in the basement doing inventory or behind the cash register. Not front and center. It's so exploited him because he even has the teenagers out doing buying and figuring out what is the next trend or what to have in the store. I mean,
I mean, part of was like, wow, that's really smart. Why would this middle-aged man know what 13-year-old girls want to buy? Get them to do it. But he's paying them minimum wage, whereas real companies would have a whole marketing team and might do something like focus groups and bring the buyer in. He's kind of figured out this brilliant way to go right to what his target market wants, but it's totally exploiting them. It's racist, and it's like it's this store that's been designed to feed all of the worst mean girl
oh, yeah.
ideas about, well, are you skinny enough to fit into this?
Right,
Oh, because
right.
I am. And like the women that they interviewed who used to work there talked about how all of that attention and fitting into those clothes and things and being featured on an Instagram thing, how they felt so superior that it
Right.
made them feel like, well, I guess I'm just a little bit prettier and a little bit skinnier and a little bit whiter than you. And that makes me better.
And by the way, the whole Italian thing was fascinating. That so this guy, the founder,
Stefan Marsan, I think, is,
his father is a t-shirt manufacturer, so he already had an in on the manufacturing of the clothing. So apparently there's this town in Prato, Italy,
Prado, yeah.
where these clothes are partially produced. So basically, they can make the t-shirt material and cut it in Prato, but then send it to China to actually sew it together. And it's still going to have the coveted Made in Italy
Italy.
label on there.
Right.
And so if any piece of the clothing passes through Prado, then you can say made in Italy, and people will think, oh, well, that's better quality, and it's not.
Yeah. No, it was I don't know what I was more disturbed by, the catering to all of the worst impulses of skinny white teenage girls, selling them tiny clothes and fat shaming them with only one size, which was tiny, or what happens afterwards with all of the, well, they're called dead white men's clothes that get sent to Ghana. And they have an incredible industry for upcycling and reusing them, but the volume that they're getting, they can't possibly handle. And if they try and put a stop to it, there's all kinds of governmental consequences and taxes and things like that. It definitely made me appreciate the care that you, a handmade garment that ostensibly you're not just going to wear a couple of times, in part because you put so much time into making it.
I try as much as I possibly can to thrift. I do like this online thrift company called ThredUp. And the nice thing is with ThredUp, that they actually put, I mean, they put sizes, but they also put dimensions. So, because so much of the time, like I can say extra large and it could be way too small or way too big. So this actually says like how wide it is. I have to say most of the time stuff fits because you think, well, I'm ordering online. I can't try it on. I don't know if it's gonna fit well if you measure yourself and then, yeah, order those measurements. It usually does work. So I really like them. The other thing too, with when you're knitting something, you're usually able to mend it. As you're learning to knit, you're also kind of learning how your garment is structured, and that gives you a lesson in how to fix it. And there's so many tutorials too out there on how to fix things. And there's the Japanese art of mending.
I love that. Yeah.
Sashiko. Yeah. So it's actually you're making your garment into a piece of art.
It reminds me of the Samantha Moore's short animation, Visible Mending. What episode was that? Do you remember?
Episode 23.
23. Yes. No, a fabulous short film. And we actually heard from her after we posted that. How much? Yeah. Do you remember what she said? It was great.
She said, "Thanks so much for sending this through. I am traveling to work on the train, working on my laptop, listening to you two talk about my film, and feeling so seen. I loved your conversation, and you two really got to grips with the deep themes of the film." And she attached her press kit because it gave some more background information on the stories that you may find of interest. So we'll put that in our show notes as well.
Yeah, if we knew what we were doing, we probably would have contacted her beforehand and had the press kit. But once again, in our efforts to make people feel better about themselves, we are going out of our way to do things ass backwards.
Yeah, I guess we could have contacted the producers of Brandy Hellbill. Oh, well.
It's a really good documentary. Its intention is not in any way to celebrate handmade garments. It's more to horrify you about the industry around it. I was so glad you recommended it to me. I'm sorry it took me so long to watch it. Do recommend it to people. First, the antidote to why we need more hand making. But so, Booty, what are you knitting these days?
I am working on the Marie Greene's Olive Knits, her 4-day knit along. I have done all of her 4-day knit alongs, and they're so much fun. You don't have to do it in 4 days. She started it because she wanted to challenge herself on the 4th of July long weekend. She wanted to see if she could knit a sweater in 4 days. And she did. I don't think it was blocked. And I really doubt the ends were woven in because she hardly ever weaves in her ends.
What I like about her.
I know. On to the next project. She would always block everything. Like, blocking is totally important to her, but not so much weaving in the ends. And so this one is called Spill the Tea, and I'm making it for my daughter who works in a tea shop. And it's bottom up, a little bit of lace work and stripes. Super cute.
Oh yeah, it's very cool. I like that color, and then it's got the lace work and then the stripes in between the lace work. Very cool.
Yeah, I think it's going to be super cute on her. And it is a fun summer knit because it's a vest, no sleeves.
No Sleeve Island.
What are you working?
Here's the outrage. As you know, I finished the baby blanket, and then my plan was to make the bunny from the same yarn, and the baby was due towards the end of July, and the baby came early, 3 weeks early. Nobody was prepared. I hadn't even started the bunny. I thought I had 3 more weeks. I'm gonna have to get going on the bunny, but and everyone in the neighborhood was traumatized by the early baby arrival. The mom, the husband who was working in Chicago and thought he had 3 more weeks and had to drive 15 hours straight to make it to the babies. The grandparents who were moving in the great grandparents the next day and thought they had 3 weeks between generations. So this family has 4 generations now living in this house. So I need to get going on the bunny, but I did turn back to Glimmer. Yes, I'm still working on that. And as I picked it up again, I was looking at what I had knit and comparing it to the picture and thinking, mine doesn't really look exactly like the picture. And then I realized that I had misread the pattern and not put in the 2 short repetitions. And of course, I've knit 15, 16 inches, so I'm not gonna frog it. So it's my new invention pattern that happens when you fail to read the actual pattern.
I think that's okay. I think I did that once and I decided to call it a design feature. I know there were times that I frogged on that. Yeah, it is a bit tough to frog because you have to get down to a point.
Right, with the
Yeah.
lace, yeah.
What you could do if you didn't want to do a lifeline through the whole thing, you could do it just in the part that's the lace work or whatever.
I am just amazed at how, as a former English professor whose ostensible skill is in close reading and teaching other people how to close read and interpret poetry and whatever it is, how often I just fail to read patterns accurately. And in this case, you do the first 16 rows, and then you're supposed to go back and repeat six. And then, yeah, and I just completely missed the bottom part at the end there that said, repeat the first 6 rows and then go to the end. Just kept going. That's what we're doing. This is 2 moments where I'm really helping other people feel better about.
Welcome.
You're welcome. Just for the Triple Crown. So, how many of those bunnies have I made? And can I find the pattern? No, I can't find the pattern. Of
Course not.
course not. I look in the 2 places I think it probably is, and then I'm like, okay, stop looking.
Right.
Print it out again and did that. But the whole time I'm like, where did I put it?
Yeah, I have life goals of having better filing systems for patterns. I have my patterns and binders, but it's not great. And it's the kind of thing where, much like your yarn, you don't start out with, okay, I'm going to have hundreds of patterns and I'm going to need to know, organize them. And so these are the categories I want and everything. You start out with a few.
I have one notebook, which I probably need to expand. Then it ends up looking like my recipe book with all this other stuff stuck in. Because that is the problem when you're organizing at the beginning and you don't know what you're going to have, how do you organize for the future?
Exactly. Future you
Future you
will thank present you.
will thank present you, but present you doesn't have a vision of the future. That's a hard thing for present you.
If anyone out there has some tips for organizing their patterns, I would love.
Yes.
And also swatches.
No idea how to do that and find it. And yeah, I find swatches in drawers and things. And I think, well, why did I stick this in here?
Yeah, because it's to do it in a filing system, it's bulky.
Yeah. Well, these are the challenges of modern life. But luckily, since we all can save so much time by eating 850 cans a year, it frees us up for more important things like organizing our patterns and things like that.
Exactly.
Well, Booty, I think we've covered a lot of ground. We've covered this January 3rd, 1955 issue of Life magazine and canned food production and our knitting, spilling the tea, going forward and going backward for me. And so I think it's time to say, whatever you do, don't
Don't knit
knit like
like
my
my sister.
sister. And definitely check out our website. We'll put some links to the things that we talked about. And thank you, as always, for tuning in.